Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Thursday morning MV Pro Call. Today is May 2nd, and I'd like to welcome those of you that are here live, as well as those of you listening to this via recording, which, of course, you can do by subscribing to Motor Vitality on whatever podcast application you happen to use, or by visiting MotorVitality.com, where you can listen to years and years and years and years worth of archives. Love having you guys on live, though. Just for the participation and the conversation, always appreciate that a lot. So we're going to start right off by the way we do pretty much every week, which is by asking, is there anything anybody learned this last week that you wish you had known before? Anything that happened that is worthy of sharing with other professionals across the country, or anything we can help with? Any questions you might have?
I did learn something new, which I think I mentioned to you, Kelly, about if this is germane, which is the distance on an air gap.
Ooh, yeah, good one, yeah. Right, talk about that, Paul.
All right, so I thought it was pretty straightforward. It was a minimum of 1 inch or twice the diameter, inside diameter of the discharge line. Then I come to find out that on many of the major codes, that's not true, the UPC code in particular. If that, or if it's within a certain distance of one wall, then it's not twice the inside diameter, it's three times the inside diameter. Or if it's near two walls, it's four times the inside diameter that air gap distance needs to be. So that I was surprised about that.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting when you shared that as well. And then I started reading some of the install manuals for some of the equipment that, you know, as you know, Paul, we have several people that come up for the installer training, and I started going back and looking at what the manuals were saying. And it's interesting because while WQA, you know, when I think I remember there being a question, of course, it's been a long time ago since I took my certified installer exam, but that was a question on there. You know, what's the minimum distance of an air gap? It's a minimum, what we always learn, what we have taught is a minimum of 1 inch or twice the diameter of the drain line, but many manufacturers recommend exactly kind of what you're saying, that although they don't spell it out with the walls, the amount of walls that are going in there, it's kind of, that was kind of interesting. I love that. I love, and we're going to talk, that's actually going to be the topic today is just education and those sorts of things. But it never ceases to amaze me how much stuff there is to learn in this industry, even after so many years. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that a lot. Anybody else have anything that they have learned or want to share or have questions?
I have a question.
Sure.
Yesterday on one of the Facebook, professional pages, someone posted about using an anion resin for PFAS removal. Has anybody heard anything about this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Me.
Okay.
Jen, you want to answer that?
Yeah. Yes. There are specialty resins out there that will handle PFAS. Now, as far as using an anion resin or any resin, any carbons, you cannot have it backwash. Otherwise, you're just backwashing the PFAS into the back into the wastewater, and they're finding that with PFAS, highest concentrations of PFAS are within as far as 25-mile radius of wastewater treatment plants. And, they're looking at, and, you know, of course, all of this is just still kind of, they're just starting to look into, and when I say just starting, probably the last couple of years, but you know how that works. But so they're finding that that's a, that is an issue is, and it could be from if somebody has a backwashing carbon filter or somebody has, you know, a reverse osmosis, then it's getting concentrated into the water.
Exactly.
Interesting. That's, and I know that we are absolutely going to this is going to be a continuing story with the PFAS, because as you said, Jen, it's an emerging contaminant, and it's, you know, we're learning more, and there are things that we don't even even know, you know, have any idea about yet, that they're researching and discovering, and you know, and realizing the ramifications of it. It's forever, it's going to be continually changing. So Jen, just to clarify, and I think to answer Stacy's question, we're not talking a regular anion resin like that you would use for nitrates. Are you aware, Paul, have you heard, can you use, you said something about it, Paul, can you use just a regular anion resin that you would use in a, you know, for a typical, say, nitrate system?
I don't know whether a regular anion resin would grab it. I know that, you know, at least one manufacturer, when Jen deals with, they offer specialized resin. It's not cheap. It's similar in cost to what you would pay for a specialized media for arsenic removal, just for those of you who deal with that. Much more expensive, and it's a throwaway in the sense of it's non-regenerable on site. I was not aware that if you did backwash either carbon or resin, that the PFAS would come off.
Yeah.
I had not heard that, but yeah, that may be the case. You know, with RO, sure, you're concentrating it. And but my argument on that is whether you put in the RO or not, the same amount of PFAS going down the drain, you know, from a house,
yeah,
especially the point of use. But in some states, one of our students at WQA that we were teaching is up in Vermont, and she said they're not allowed to do anything that creates any kind of a waste stream, even point of use RO, I think she said, that Vermont's kind of strict about it. So
right. Massachusetts is the same way, where you have to collect the PFAS prior to any backwashing, anything that will flush down the drain. So, and if you decide to use carbon, you can use carbon, but it has to be in out. It can't be a backwashing system.
Really?
No. Yeah. And so, and which is, you know, frustrating in a way, because when you're using, whether it's carbon or a specialty resin, then you want to try to take everything out so you're only capturing the PFAS. And but if they're not allowing you to use a backwashing system, then you have to collect PFAS and whatever else that resin is going, or carbon is going to grab onto. So you're going to have less throughput with that. You know, you're not going to be able to have as much capacity because you're collecting other things also.
You know, what I think is...
You're going to be replacing that filter all the time.
Pardon me?
I said you're going to be replacing that filter all the time.
Or rebedding media.
Rebedding, right. And, yeah, and you know, that's... most of the manufacturers can also do projections. They take your water sample, and then they can check and see what you are, you know, how much. And now going back to the resin side of things versus carbon... Resin does have a longer lifespan, is what they're finding.
Right.
So,
you know, it's the one thing that is going to impact us is, you know, I think we're going to begin to see disposal regulations as well, right? So you're not allowed to regenerate it. That means that you're not going to be allowed to just, when you rebed it, dump it out of the shop vac or whatever you're using to, you know, to rebed it and throw the thing, you know, throw the stuff in the dumpster. And because now it's going to be considered a hazardous waste, which is really interesting, because one of the things that we have to keep in mind in regards to PFAS is PFAS in the water is only one way, and not even the most common way, that people are getting exposed to PFAS. I mean, it certainly is a big factor, right? It's in the water supplies, and it is one way, and it is relevant to our industry, and so it's what we address. But PFAS is pretty much everywhere. It's on the, you know, I'm getting ready to go do a little 20-mile loop backpacking this weekend. And as I was packing up my backpack, I'm looking at all my waterproof stuff, and that's all PFAS. You know, all the Patagonia stuff, and you know, all that stuff it's got PFAS in it, and so. I mean, this stuff is everywhere. It sort of permeates our, not just our water supplies, but I mean, even, you know, our food wrappers, you know, and our
carpeting is number one.
Carpeting, yeah, carpeting. What was that?
One article I read said our exposure to PFAS via the water is only about 20% of our total.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Carpeting, Jen. You said that the stain guard or on furniture, right? The stain guard they put on furniture. Same thing. So you know, you're sitting on the couch that has your stain guard on there, and that's got some of the elements of PFAS in there. So definitely a factor. Speaking of which, I know that this is going to be a huge topic for those of us heading out to DC next week. And so next week's call, we'll sort of do a recap on what we talked about in DC. And I hope that anybody that's out there will come on and participate and talk about your experiences with it. But this will, we're headed out. There's, I think, about 50 people from the Water Quality Association, members of the Water Quality Association going out, and we're going to be sitting down with legislators and talking about, I'm sure this is going to be one of the primary issues that we're discussing. So, yeah, great question, Stacey. And I'd say stay tuned. We will continue to spread the information as we learn it, for sure. So, anybody else before we jump into our topic today? So I wanted to kind of follow up on what we talked about last week. Last week we talked about questions, right? Asking questions, and the example that I give anytime I'm teaching a group of salespeople, I usually do start by talking about the need to emulate other professionals. If we are going to be something other than a salesperson, we need to, if we want to be sales professional, and we don't just look at those two words as semantics, right? Oh, there's a salesperson or there's a sales professional. All right, yeah, it's just a fancy way of saying salesperson. I don't see it that way. I really believe that there is a difference between a salesperson and a sales professional. And if you are a professional, then you emulate what other professionals do. And last week we sort of talked about the when you go to the doctor, how they spend, in a doctor's appointment, they're spending 80 or 90% of the time, hopefully, diagnosing the problem, and only 5 to 10% of the time giving you a recommendation, telling you what they believe you should do. And if it were the opposite, if they spent the, 90% of the time telling you what you should do and only 10% of the time diagnosing, I think it would be only natural that we would want to seek a second opinion or a third opinion. And I think that's the same way with sales professionals as well. If we spend way more time telling the customer what they should do than diagnosing or asking the questions, then we're, that we can't be surprised when they decide to look at other options, right, or to shop around. Today I wanted to sort of take another part of the characteristics of those professionals and talk about the continued education part, the learning part, because I think everybody would agree that, I personally would not want to go to a doctor that hadn't learned anything since med school, that hadn't studied and continued their education. And so that's what I wanted to talk about today, is just a discussion on the different ways that we can get continued education. Now, there's the formal stuff, right? Those of you that are certified, WQA certified, and by the way, in regards to certification, let me just take a little real quick sidebar here and say, I believe if you're not certified, this is something I would strongly encourage you to consider doing sooner than later, because I think it's going to become necessary as they look at the PFAS, addressing the PFAS issue with the point of use and point of entry technology that we have. I believe that they are going to be looking at certified products and certified personnel to install and service and maintain those products. And I really believe that if you do not have those certifications, it may have an impact on your career, your job in the coming years. So we think the WQA certification, obviously, they require a certain amount of continued education. And by the way, that's the case with just about every, you know, every profession that's out there. They have to get recertified in some way. You know, paramedics or police officers have to go through retraining. Even in the military, you have to have your, you know, your test. And doctors have to have certain levels of continued education, and they have to submit. Doctors, by the way, also to maintain their license, have to submit in even continue well after they've had their license. They have to submit information for like into journals or you know. So it's not only receiving that continued education; they often have to submit in order to maintain their license to contribute to the industry and participate in it as well. But it's pretty much the case with every profession. Realtors have to have continued education. You know, just about everybody. So I want to open it up a little bit here and ask you guys, what do you do for continued education? How do you keep from getting stagnant? I can tell you for me personally, and if you came on at the beginning of this call, you heard, you know, the discussion of learning something new. I'm always amazed at how much there is to learn. And, you know, but how do you guys, what do you do for your CE, for your continued education, whether it's formal or informal? What do you do? How do you stay on top of the newest information?
A lot of times, Google alerts.
Good one. Google alerts are good. Yeah.
Uh huh.
Talk about Google alerts for a second, Stacey. What are Google alerts? We've had calls on this in the past, but talk about it. That's a great one.
You can go into your Google account and set up Google alerts. It's been a while since I've done it, but you can basically type in certain, you know, words that you want it tracking for, and they'll send you a daily update of that stuff that's come up in articles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes, like one of the ones that I have is water, and I'll get 10 articles in an email that have something to do with water, and some of them are not really relevant. Like they'll say, mayor in hot water, right? Well, you can, but it is a way to, you know, you can go through and just kind of look at the headlines, and it's absolutely a way to stay on top of what's happening out there with water. Absolutely. That's a great one. If you don't know how to find Google alerts, just simply Google alerts. it will pull you right to it and explain you exactly what to do. You can determine how often it sends you the emails, or you can narrow it down based on different titles and everything, but that's a great one. Very good. What else?
A couple of things that I also do is like the Facebook professional pages.
Yeah.
Whether it's for my company or like the one that you and Jennifer moderate some. And
Water Treatment Pros, yeah.
Yeah, Water Treatment Pros. That also LinkedIn, you know, following a lot of the professionals in the industry, they'll post things on LinkedIn also.
Yeah. Articles and little things like that. So I 100% agree with you that those are great. You know, in terms of the Facebook groups, I think I mentioned a couple weeks ago, and I can't believe it took me this long to do this, but I went on and joined a bunch of the plumbing groups it's been a couple months now. I went on and joined a couple of the plumbing groups, and it's, number one, amazing how often the topic of water treatment comes up in those groups. Number two, I can't believe how much stuff I learn. But there's one that I just love kind of watching. It's called Plumbing Fails. It's a group called Plumbing Fails, and it's got thousands of members, but they come on and they post pictures of plumbing hack jobs, I guess. And most of them I can look at and go, wow, I would never do that. Some of them I have to go in and read the comments to figure out what's wrong with it. And then I'm going, wow, I didn't know that. That's a job that I might have actually done, you know. So you're right. That's a really good, expand out of your bubble a little bit. The Facebook groups and even if you're not participating, sort of watching and reading what others are saying, and it gives you a feel for the industry. Those are great ideas, excellent ideas. What else? What else do we have?
The Well Driller Facebook groups are also really good.
Well Drillers. Oh, yeah, it's a good one. Absolutely.
There's a Well Driller, or I'm sorry, it's a private well question or well owners group, and it's where they ask questions about their well. But then I would say, honestly, I think probably 70%, 70-80% is on water treatment. And that's a great one. And I appreciate the answers that I see also from, you know, experts I recognize in the industry.
Yeah, sure. No, that's so well drillers, absolutely. And I mean, they're related fields, right? That it expands outside of that bubble for sure. Great one. What else do we have?
Magazines?
Sure. So industry magazines, or are there others that you can read and learn from as well?
And webinars.
So, yeah, webinars. Where do you find, so where do you, what magazines and what webinars?
I think it's called the Water Products Magazine.
Yep, Water Quality Products, yep.
Exactly. So they specify products that are trending and the ones that are most common, and they have some literature on article issues in specific places.
Yeah. So I think there's Water Conditioning and Purification, there's Water Quality Products Magazine, and I think I haven't seen it in a long time, and I don't think they do a paper version of it, but there used to be Water Technology Online, and I think that one is sort of gone by the wayside a little bit. The webinars, go ahead.
The water technology, it's turned very industrial. Like, I've logged on to a few times, and it's way above my head. very industrial. I still, you know, you can pick up stuff every once in a while.
Yeah,
Another thought, you know, of course, we all join this podcast every Thursday.
Thank you, Jen. I was going to say that. Yeah,
there's other podcasts. WQA puts out their podcast, which is really interesting. And then Aqua Urbans puts out theirs. Oh, gosh, what is theirs? Is there Urbans Aqua? I'm sorry. Urbans Aqua puts theirs out.
Yeah.
And I think it's Urban Talks. I don't remember, but I log on to that every once in a while as I'm driving, it's a really good one too.
Yeah. No, I think podcasts are absolutely a way to go. And thank you, everybody. And thank you, Jen, for pointing that out. That I hope that this call every Thursday is one of those ways that we can do it. Podcasts, especially when you've got that windshield time. What else? I mean, YouTube, you know, is a good one, right? I don't know if you guys, we had as a guest a couple months back, Gary the Water Guy, who was a great guest, and he's got a pretty cool channel on YouTube. A lot of times when, you know, actually somebody said that YouTube is one of the most popular search engines out there. And of course it's owned by Google now, but YouTube, huge searches on YouTube. So, that's absolutely a source. As with anything, you know, it's trust but verify, right? Anytime you're reading something or seeing something, it's one of those things, and we see this on the Facebook groups for sure, where you read something, you can't take it as gospel, you know, but it does give you a starting point for continuing to do your research. And even if you hear something that is there's a lot of things out there that are commonly accepted that are not 100% accurate. Let me give you one, I guess, that wouldn't be that controversial, right? pH. Anybody know what pH stands for? What does pH stand for? Anybody know what the pH stands for?
This is really bad. I don't.
So if you Google what does pH stand for, the number one answer that comes up is potential of hydrogen. And okay. And that's really common. It's what everybody and I because it's so commonly believed, you Google it. Number one answer, potential of hydrogen. It's what comes up. But if you happen to run across somebody with a PhD in chemistry, which I often do because Dr. Tanya Lubner with the WQA, they will point out that that's completely incorrect. In fact, the P itself is not actually a P. It's a mathematical symbol that it stands for the negative log base of a number. The H does stand for hydrogen, which is why the H is always capitalized and the P is always lowercase, because the P is not actually a P. The P is actually a math symbol. And it means that pH scale is based on a logarithmic scale. Now, does it matter? I mean, can you still say potential of hydrogen? Of course, because in a way, that's what pH is. It does have to do with how much, with the amount of hydrogen that is in a solution. So it's not like it's horrible. But if you stopped strictly at the first Google search, that's what you're going to know. It's a starting point for delving in deeper, for learning more, for going through and asking those questions. And that's a lot of what the continued education is. Why is it important in the last 3 minutes that we have here? Why do you guys feel it's important to look for those ways to continue to grow, to have that continued education? Why is that important? Anybody? Anybody? Just because it is? Because it is, right?
Yeah,
what do you guys think?
We're professionals. We're supposed to know this industry.
I mean, that's what it is, right? Again, would we want to go to a doctor that hadn't learned anything since med school?
Right.
And guys, we have to start to see ourselves as professionals. If we, we talked last week about why can a doctor ask how the patient's going to pay for their service call before they even meet the person or see the doctor. It's because we just assume that doctor is professional. Yet in our industry, customers are constantly, number one, a lot of the people that are presenting the products are afraid to talk about our prices. And number two, customers are always trying to beat us up over the price. They're trying to, and it's because they don't see us as professionals. Well, I would submit that they don't see us often as professionals because many of us don't see ourselves as professionals. And if we're going to, if we want our customers to see us as professional, then we have to start emulating what other professionals do. And that's everything that other professionals do. Our attire, the way we present ourselves, our communication, the questions we ask, the knowledge that we have. Our participation in the industry and the growth of the industry, those of you going to Washington, D.C. next week, I think that's a prime example, right? Getting involved. You don't have to fly to Washington, D.C. for that to happen, though. Go to your local village council meetings and get involved in your community and participate in the growth of the industry. Get your certifications, those types of things. Those are things that are going to help us emulate what other professionals do. Any final thoughts or comments on this before we have to close up today? Anybody? All right. Well, I will hopefully see many of you in D.C. Next week. Otherwise, we will talk to you next Thursday, if not before. Everybody, please be safe. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks.